even though I was giving, I was getting back. I got to meet and direct Gwyneth Paltrow. Well, let me say it again. Matt Weiss, a traffic lawyer from New York with no experience whatsoever, got to direct an Oscar-winning actress. I mean, how cool is that experience?
From Washington, D.C., this is The Tightrope. I'm your host, Dan Smolin. Our mission on this podcast is to help you realize your dreams of doing meaningful work. Here you'll meet and be inspired by amazing people who overcame great odds. You'll discover what sparked them, how they explored work opportunities, the strategies that they employed to ensure career success, and the actions they boldly took to make it all happen. You'll also meet esteemed and nationally recognized thought leaders who are helping people like you to develop work skill, experience, and leadership, and seize opportunity from a changing world so that your beautiful work dreams turn into reality. Together, let's turn work meaningful, for meaningful work is the future of work. Matthew Weiss is a successful attorney and a restless dreamer. He built a formidable New York City-based private law practice that has helped thousands of people, and yet he yearned for greater purpose in his life and career. A chance meeting with the father of a fallen 9/11 hero would radically change his life and unexpectedly pivot his career in a new and meaningful direction as a filmmaker. Matthew's debut film, the documentary called Man in Red Bandana, memorializes the life of Wells Crowther, a 24-year-old equities trader who worked in the World Trade Center. As the Twin Towers burned on September 11, 2001, Wells escorted at least 10 people to safety before losing his own life when the South Tower he was in collapsed. Man in Red Bandana debuted in September 2017 and won critical acclaim. Then he co-produced his first feature film, Vault, which stars Chaz Palminteri and Don Johnson. The movie recalls the true story of one of the largest heists in American history. To learn about Matthew Weiss's meaningful work journey, we spoke with him in November 2019 via Skype. So Matthew Weiss, welcome to The Tightrope.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
So let's travel back in time to your home in the Long Island suburbs. When you were young, settling into bed after a long day at school or at play, what did you dream about being when you were all grown up?
Tough question, but the general answer is I always liked business. I always liked making money. And even as a kid, I did the proverbial lemonade stand. And then around 14, 15, I got into magic, and I would do magic shows for younger kids and get paid for that. And then even in college, in my junior year doing college full-time, I started with two friends a teddy bear delivery service. And so I really enjoyed running a business, overseeing a business, solving business problems. And so I always knew that I'd be some type of entrepreneur, some type of business owner. So that was kind of my dream of some type without knowing exactly what I would sell.
An important bit of disclosure here. You, Matthew Weiss, are my brother-in-law. So when your sister, my wife, Marcia, brought me home the first time to meet your family, I think I missed you by an hour. You were probably headed back to college. But what she did do was introduce me to your magician gear. And that stayed with me all these years. So I know you had an entrepreneurial streak in you, but I have to ask, were you also preparing secretly for work in the creative arts?
Well, I always had a creative side. The magic certainly gave me that. You know, when you do a trick, you have to kind of flow it to the next trick and kind of, if you can, use a prop from the first trick for the next trick. So, and then there's this performance element. So I certainly tapped into my creative juices in that hobby. Then, of course, you go to academia and you're in college and you're basically just repeating and regurgitating back stuff you've learned. Although I do remember doing a report on Gulliver's Travels, and I took the paper and I used like an old parchment, and then I burned all the edges and had like a burn, and then I rolled it into a scroll and I tied it, and I handed in my paper with this frayed edged scroll, and it kind of used old English, and I got an A. on that. Just for, I think because of creativity, not so much for the content. It was just such an unusual way to present the story, I guess. And so, you know, I do like and I do have a creative outlet, but I didn't have the opportunity to use it for many years, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, at some point. But I went to law school and got my law degree, and the idea was that it takes 3 years to get a law degree. It only takes 2 years to get an MBA. I'll definitely get that MBA at some point, but let me get the law degree now because that it takes longer and it's more of a commitment. Many CEOs, business leaders have that law degree. So just knowing the knowledge of being able to read an agreement or understanding litigation, I thought was a great asset for me to have. And then I ended up getting this great job working for the Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York State. And that was kind of ivory tower and fun and sexy and, you know, working on really cutting edge type of decisions and cases. So I kind of put off my MBA goals and took on that job. And then after I finished my 2 year commitment at the Court of Appeals, I was, going to get my MBA, and I took the GMAT, the business test, and applied for a bunch of business schools. And then I got another offer from a law firm with 300 attorneys, and they offered me all this good money, and I went with the money, and I never got that MBA. So I practiced law for this big firm for 2 years, and then a buddy of mine from law school kept calling me and asking me, you know, would you like to go out with him and have our own law firm? And I put him off 3, 4, 5 times, but he was persistent. And eventually, I realized that at this big firm, it's very political, and they only are really interested in large clients like a town or a public company. And I didn't think that I would be able to generate business. So I realized that they would spit me out after 5, 6, 7, 8 years for someone cheaper. Mm-hmm. So I went with my buddy, my law school buddy, and him and I opened up a law firm together. And I felt like I had made it home. Like I was at cloud nine, so excited, even though we had a closet-sized office and I would have to get up out of my chair for him to reach his desk. We were in heaven, but me in particular, because I finally was an owner of a business and able to run a business, something that I had done briefly through my young career and even childhood, but something that I had longed for. And I have never looked back. I've been an entrepreneur, business owner since then, which was 1991.
So let's talk about that. Okay, you took us through a lot of history, but let's talk about that first day in the law practice. I remember when your mother called me up on the phone and literally described how small your office was. It was like a closet.
It's not fair to bring my mother into this.
Well, I mean, listen, she was proud of you, Matt, but she was also in awe of your entrepreneurial spirit. Now, let me get into what that was. So take us back in time to a day when you and your law partner are in New York Superior Court handling a case. You come upon somebody asking for help. I'm going to let you take it from there to tell us what happened next.
Sure. So my partner who got me out of the big world of, big law firm world, he had friendship with a lawyer who did a lot of traffic ticket work and also criminal. And the criminal work were larger fees. So he asked us for help to appear in traffic court for his clients. And so my first day in traffic court was an eye-opener because unlike many other legal places, in traffic court, especially New York City, people will come up to you and hire you on the spot. Now, you can't normally do that as a lawyer, you know, if you're in a courtroom setting or some type of legal setting, usually the lawyer already has a client. But these are people that are coming in to fight their speeding ticket, their red light ticket, their moving violation ticket of some type, and they got nervous or they saw a lawyer, didn't know that lawyers do this kind of work, but they see someone with a suit and tie, they approach them, and they ask, hey, are you a lawyer or can you help me? And so my first day, 2 or 3 or 4 people actually came up to me and hired me on the spot. Now, fortunately, I was able to reschedule those cases because I was still learning the ropes. And while it doesn't take that long to become an expert in vehicle traffic law, it was my first day, keep in mind. And I was so excited. I'm like, this is incredible that you could actually generate business on your feet. And of course, you're handling other cases that this other attorney was hiring us on. And then you would meet new clients and get them hired, get hired by them. And it got to a point where we had so many clients, you know, I was giving out a box of business cards a month.
Wow.
Now, to put that in perspective, I give out a box of business cards maybe every 3 years now. But you win a case for someone, you give them 10 or 20 cards, and you say, here, give them to your friends, and they happily do it. And all of a sudden, they're giving out cards, and people were coming in with my card looking for me. And, you know, I was just building up this practice where it got to a point where the attorney who was initially sending us his work, we were helping him out, but we were more busy with our own clients. I realized that there were about four, five, six people like me in this particular court, and that in New York City at the time, there were five or six similar courts just like this. And I said to myself, well, in each one of these courts are five or six guys like me, and why can't I create a brand and a business with this labor force that already exists? You know, keep in mind that to fight a ticket, it only takes you 5 to 6 or 8 minutes to do one ticket. And if these lawyers are there anyway, they're happy to spend another 5 to 8 minutes to fight a case because it's just more money for them, and they're there anyway. It's not like I have to go special. And so I saw a source of relatively inexpensive labor that was competent, and I kind of got to know all the lawyers and which ones are the best in each court. And so from there, we built a brand. And I got a logo and a tagline, and I am proud that I've imported a lot of things that you would see in other industries in the legal world, because in the legal world, it's rare for a law firm to have a real brand. Right. You might have a logo, you might even have a tagline, but most lawyers don't. And yet, in the traffic ticket world, I made it work and work successfully. And so we built that business up over time, and eventually I bought out my partner, and it continues to this day. So since 1993, we've been fighting traffic tickets all over New York City and now all over New York State. We do about 6,000 tickets a year, and I have about 20 to 30 lawyers that work for me that fight these tickets. They're all 1099 because they all have their own law firms, mm-hmm. and this is extra work that I provide to them. And it's been, you know, a great run for me because for like 100 reasons. It's low pressure. It's only a ticket. It's fungible. It's very easy to give another lawyer who is covering your case the information, and he or she knows what to do pretty easily without a lot of background. I mentioned the labor that exists. It's not that hard an expertise to become proficient in. So within a relatively short time, you can be a quote-unquote expert. So there's a lot of benefits of traffic law that I saw. I could scale a business and be successful and profitable. So I kind of used that entrepreneurial spirit that I had from my lemonade stand in the law and scaled up and built a business that basically runs itself at this point. I spend, you know, a fair amount of time just overseeing important things, but, you know, the bread and butter work of fighting the tickets and processing information from beginning to end is handled by my staff and attorneys.
From nothing, you built a formidable business to rise to become one of the, if not the largest, traffic law practices in New York City. But let's talk about a meaningfulness aspect, which is, as good as it is collecting business that way and generating business that way, it must feel really good to win a case for somebody who is otherwise powerless. You know, to go before a court, you know, with a traffic violation or something. I mean, you represented cabbies who, you know, they were running their own businesses too. What does that feel like to help somebody who otherwise couldn't help themselves before the eyes of the law?
That's a really astute question, because in New York City, it's very hard to win any traffic ticket. It's very different from the rest of the state of New York, because in New York City, for one, they don't plea bargain. They don't make any deals. So if you fight your ticket, you plead not guilty, then the only thing that the court can do is give you a hearing date, and at that hearing date, you either win or lose. You can't get a 6-point ticket reduced to a 2-point ticket and pay a lesser fine or the same fine. They don't care about your driving record. All they care about is, did you commit this offense or not? And if so, you're getting the guilty, you're getting the points, and then we'll determine a fine within a range. So having this all or nothing court makes it very daunting for most motorists who rarely get a ticket or don't go to this court regularly and aren't trained in the law. And then they show up and they're asked to basically represent themselves in a position where they don't know how to cross-examine and they don't know how to ask questions or present their case and present their evidence. So we certainly feel like we're providing a great service for people that don't know what to do, and even if they have a competency, they might be emotional about it. They might be mad. They might be scared. There's a lot of emotions that run with getting a ticket and being charged. Often, for most of our clients, this is their first and only time with interaction with a police officer. So there's a lot of emotions that run through it, and certainly we provide a great service because we can be objective about it. We can be informed, experienced, and help them through the system. And you couple that on the fact that the city of New York has created a system that's very, pro-police is the best way to put it. Mm. There's all types of rules that make it very hard for the motorist and easy for the cops. Specifically, for instance, the officer does not have to have any discovery, doesn't have to show you anything before the hearing. So on the hearing, you get whatever discovery there is, whether documents or records, and you have to analyze it and look at it on the spot and come up with your arguments without any preparation, which is very different from most legal settings when you have full disclosure, full discovery. And another rule that exists is that the judge can ask questions that essentially helps the officer. So now you have the judge is allowed to be active and an advocate for the police to help the cop present his or her case. And again, that makes it very, very difficult for motorists. And so we clearly feel like we're providing a great service for people for all the reasons I mentioned, because it is a very tough venue, because they're usually emotional about it, and if not, certainly not experienced. And most of our clients, actually, they have such confidence in us, they don't even come to court. They're happy to let us deal with it and fight it for them so they don't have to waste their time, and they trust us that we're going to do our very best to see if we can get them out of what is a difficult situation. Of course, one of the biggest challenges that we have is letting clients know and explaining up front, before they give us any money, that it's a very difficult court, it's an uphill battle, there's a good chance they'll lose, because the last thing we want is someone to hire us and then be disappointed because they were still found guilty, which is a reasonable outcome and a likely outcome for many people.
So, a point of personal privilege, many years ago, I got jammed up in a situation which I called you about, and it had to do with a moving violation at National Airport, where suddenly the speed limit went from like 55 down to like 20, and I got nailed. I got nailed, and there were extenuating circumstances. There was rain on the road and stuff like that. Anyway, I knew that I was over my head. And I remember calling you, and you were you said, listen, I can't be in the courtroom with you. I can't represent you. But what I will tell you is be respectful. Answer only what you're asked. Don't freelance, and kind of keep your head down. And I followed it to the T. I got whatever happened to me pled down, cost me a lot of money. But you know what? In the end, I was okay. I lived to see another day. I remember there was somebody in the courtroom who had come in from like Wheeling, West Virginia, and I guess she was going to the airport, and she got nailed doing 20 over the speed limit, and she got in a lot of trouble. And this woman was so upset that she kept cutting the judge off. Well, make the long story short, he was not having any part of it. And he revoked her license, and she said, how am I supposed to get home? And he basically said, that's your problem. And
wow.
So again, I give you props because we mortal beings go into that courtroom totally unprepared for the experience. And it sounds to me like over many, many years, you've done right by your clients.
Well, of course, we feel, we want to do our best and we want them to get the best result we can. And, most people have pride in their work and they want to win. No one likes to lose. It's never fun to lose. And certainly what we do, you need thick skin, because you're going to lose a lot of patients. You know, it's almost like triage in a war zone, right? You do your best to save as many, how much life and limb as you can, but you know you're not going to help with everyone, and you just keep going on to the next one. And so we do that. And if you lose, well, you're supposed to lose. Keep in mind, most of the people that get a ticket are probably guilty. So, you know, cops generally are not out there to just make up stuff. Right. So when we do represent someone and we do win, we kind of beat the system for them. And that's why they're so elated when we win, because they kind of know they were guilty. You know, they kind of know that, you know, that they did something wrong, you know, and the ones that lose, they kind of know that they should have got the ticket. They should have lost.
So things have gone very, very well for you at your law firm, and you're in court one day and in yet another chance encounter. At the courthouse, you suddenly meet a gentleman by the name of Jeff Crowther, the father of the late Wells Crowther, who happened to be a hero of 9/11. Tell us about that chance meeting.
So, actually, I met him not in a traffic court. Believe it or not, I met him at a CLE program. So his law firm specialized in, Jeff Crowther is a banker, and his bank specialized in helping lawyers with their accounts. And so they have these CLE, which is continuing legal education that lawyers in New York need to do 24 hours every 2 years. So he had this free program, which I attended. I got to meet him. And one thing led to another, and I decided to hire his bank to do the banking for my law firm. And in sign of appreciation, Jeff invited me to lunch to like seal the deal. And I had no expectations for the lunch other than a nice meal and to get to know Jeff and his partner better. And over lunch, he told me the story about his son, and I was just blown away. His son, as you mentioned, is Wells Crowther, and he's known as the man in the red bandana. And specifically, what I said to myself in quick succession is, what an amazing story. Everyone needs to hear this story. I want to share this story with everyone. Now, keep in mind, I never read a book on filmmaking. I never took a class in filmmaking, but I had the passion to share a story. And so I like to say that filmmakers look for stories. This was a story that found the filmmaker, because I wanted as many people to hear this story and learn about Wells and learn about his selflessness and sacrifice and courage. And hopefully by hearing and watching Wells' story, it makes them better people, because I know knowing about Wells and thinking about him regularly makes me a better person. And I got Jeff's permission. And I started a 6-year process of researching, writing, and ultimately making and releasing a documentary film about his son, Wells, called Man in Red Bandana.
All right, so let's talk about that. You want to tell this story, and you've never before even considered a pivot into filmmaking. I mean, you're an attorney. You're a full-time attorney. So take us through the process that you went through to become a filmmaker.
You know, it really was a passion to share this story. And so the first thing I did once I got permission from the family was to start researching. So I started watching new segments about Wells that were on NBC and ABC, CNN. I started pulling, Googling articles about Wells and copying them and making a file and reading as much as I could about Wells. And from there, I started researching 9/11 and how Wells' story fell within the much bigger disaster of that day. And from there, I started outlining and coming up with a progression of, chapters and then filling that in. And, it was a work in progress. It was an iterative process. It didn't happen with the first shot. It took a while, and then things would be moved around. But honestly, and surprisingly to me, I felt really comfortable with the research and writing and storytelling, because as an attorney for many years, I had been telling stories and researching and writing for clients, professionally. You know, even though we primarily do traffic ticket law, I've also done appellate work, as you heard when I was at the Court of Appeals. And then even in private practice, I did, motions and litigation paperwork. And so I've had a lot of experience in telling stories for clients, And this was a different type of storytelling, but I felt very comfortable with the research and writing. It was when we got to cameras and lighting and editing where I needed help and I needed to build a team. And certainly my leadership skills, my hiring ability to vet people came into play. But ultimately, I had to rely in large part on the experts to do some of the work that needed to get done.
So as the chief storyteller here, briefly tell us Wells' story.
Wells worked on the 104th floor of the South Tower. He was an equities trader, and he was there when the building got struck. Actually, his building was the South Tower. The North Tower got struck first, and he called his roommate, and he told his roommate that he was fine and he was going to get out. And then a few minutes later, the South Tower got struck, and since he was on 104, and the United Airlines Flight 11 struck from 77 to 84, we believe strongly that Wells was above the impact zone. Mm-hmm. And after that second impact, Wells called his mom, and it went into voicemail, so he left a message for her, which you hear in the film, which is, "Hello, Mom, this is Wells. I just want you to know that I'm okay." And that was the last time that anyone heard from Wells. Mm. Because when the building came down 56 minutes after it was hit, he was never heard from again. Mm. His family spent days looking for him, and obviously they were devastated losing their only son. And then when you see the film, you'll see what a great kid he was, always looked after others first. He always praised others, supported others. He was captain of his hockey team. Just a great kid. He volunteered for as a volunteer fireman for NIAC Fire Department. Mm. And just a great kid. And they were just utterly devastated. And his mom and dad, they went and sent flyers, gave DNA sample. His friends were at hospitals searching in rooms for him. Their mom at 3 in the morning, because that was the only time she could get through, was calling hospitals. And eventually, after a few days to a week, they realized he's not alive, and he didn't make it out. And they were utterly devastated, as you can imagine, and heartbroken. And they had a memorial service for him, no body, because obviously they had no body to honor, to lay to rest. But Mom, even after that memorial service, never gave up looking for Wells. She always read newspapers, magazine articles, watched documentaries, news reports, anything she could. She had this irrational, what she calls irrational search, that she had to find something and that she hoped on the off chance that she would. Well, 8 months later, so now we're in May of 2002, the New York Times did a lengthy article. 5 journalists contributed to basically paint a picture of what it was like to be in the tower on 9/11 and what these survivors saw and how they got out. And Wells' mom, Allison, is reading it. And in there, she read about 2 women who both said that they were saved, lit up and out, by a man with a red bandana on his face. Mm. As soon as she read that, she knew instantly that they were talking about Wells, mm-hmm. because Wells, from the age of 8, always carried his red bandana. Mm-hmm. It was this habit he got into. His friends would tease him about it, and he didn't care. He always had his bandana, mm-hmm. even when he was working, many years later. So when she saw 2 women who said that this man saved them with a red bandana, it sounded like Wells, and it certainly he had the trademark and unique item that Wells would carry. Mm-hmm. So she sends photos to both the women, who positively ID'd, "This is the man that saved us. Mm-hmm. Your son is a hero," and thanked them profusely. And a few months later, these 2 women with their husbands came to Wells' home for a barbecue. And from there, Allison and Jeff were able to ask questions and get further details, learning more about Wells and what he did during that last hour of his life. Mm. His finest hour, by all accounts.
Indeed.
And they learned at that barbecue that he put out fires with the fire extinguisher that he found. He extricated people that were trapped. He actually carried a woman down 17 flights with another group, left her on 61 in a safe, clean air, and then went back up, let another group down, and about 5 flights, went back up a third time, and let yet another group down. Ultimately, he led at least 10 people to safety that we figured out.
That's astounding.
So, astounding. And so one of the things that I wanted to do as the filmmaker is to advance the story, add to the story. Wells' story had been told, as you heard earlier, from different news outlets and newspapers. And certainly the 9/11 report and the 9/11 Commission report was a lengthy explanation of what everything that happened. And then even, you know, different outlets discussed Wells. So I wanted to add to it. So one of the things that I'm proud that I was able to add was the fact that there was research that showed that only 18 people escaped the South Tower, Wells' Tower, at or above where the plane hit. Mm. And that wasn't my research, but I was the first to figure out that Wells saved at least 10 of those 18 people. Now, the significance of that is not only did he save at least 10 people in the upper reaches of the South Tower, but he saved people that were statistically likely were to die. There was only one escape route out from above where the plane hit, and Wells had found it and led these 10 people through this maze and through down to safety. And so I thought that was one of a few incredible things to really add luster and more saintly activity that Wells performed that day.
It's an amazing story, and you brought it to a cinematic level. You know, you said to me once, I didn't have a lot of money, but I had to go big with what I had to invest in this project. And you did a couple of things to give this an A-lister cachet. You brought on a Grammy-winning musician to write your movie's theme song, and then an Oscar-winning actress to provide narration to the documentary. Who were those people?
Lyle Lovett recorded a song for our film. He didn't write the song, but another thing that I wanted to add to Wells' story that hadn't been done to advance his story, as I mentioned, was the legacy he continues to have throughout the United States. There are songs written about him. There are poems, artwork in his honor. There are actually babies all over the country named after Wells. In fact, there was just a new baby born in Iowa, and we posted it on our Facebook page just recently, who we just found out about. So adding that legacy piece was very important to us. And so it dawned on me that asking a musician to write a song is a really, really big ask. Mm-hmm. But asking him to record an existing song, while it's still a huge favor, especially from someone like Lyle Lovett, who won Grammys, as you mentioned, it's a more doable ask because they don't have to start from scratch. Mm-hmm. And so we got the sheet music and got it to him through a friend, and he thought the story was incredible and wanted to be part of it. And he didn't charge us. He didn't ask for any money or any points on the movie. And he recorded the song that you hear at the end credits called One Red Bandana. And it's a beautiful homage to Wells. And then similarly, we were able to get our script on Gwyneth Paltrow's desk. She read this script and thought that it was amazing. And she, again, for no monetary benefit, wanted to be involved. And she, for the first time in her career, agreed to narrate a documentary. And so she and I worked together for half a day, and you'll hear her voice. And one of the great backstories about Gwyneth is, I never envisioned a woman to be the narrator. I always thought it would be a male. One, because I'm a male and I'm writing in my head. I'm thinking and talking to myself as a male. And, you know, I felt, you know, Wells and his father and, you know, there's a lot of men dominate the story. Firefighters, first responders were mostly men. So I felt it would be a male narrator. But when a friend of mine introduced me to Gwyneth's PR person, was actually for Alec Baldwin. And he presented to Alec, but he also said he would present it to Gwyneth. And I knew who he was talking about because how many Gwyneths are there in Hollywood? Mm-hmm. And as soon as he hung up the phone, I felt like a fool that I didn't realize that a woman would have been such a better choice. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping Alec was a no and Gwyneth was a yes, because when you get to see the film, you realize it's very harsh and raw and sad at points. Mm-hmm. And Gwyneth's female voice provides some softness and balance to a very difficult story at times to hear. And so I think that maybe it's accidental genius. You know, I just, you know, had good karma because I was able to get this incredible actress who did an amazing job and certainly added the fact that it was a female voice, I think certainly added to the storytelling and made it a much stronger film.
So Man in Red Bandana premiered, I believe, in September 2017?
Correct.
And you screened it for audiences across the country and here in D.C. as well. That's where Marcia and I got to see it. What I remember most about that was as the movie ended and the house lights came up, how emotionally spent the audience was. Some of the people, especially the couple next to us, were weeping. What did you discover from that experience that you hadn't learned in all of your hard work and long hours producing and editing and getting the film ready for release?
Well, two things in answer to that question. What I discovered about myself is that my storytelling in the legal world had was more expansive. I wasn't limited to just a plaintiff or defendant, but I could tell much bigger stories. And being able to tap into people's emotions and make them cry, make them inspired, was something that I could do. But the other part, which I think separates this film from pretty much any other film you ever watch, is this film takes you down. You, at some point early on, you get to like Wells, and then you can't help but your heart breaks for Wells because he's in jeopardy, and then you find out that he didn't make it out of the building. And you hear Jeff, for instance, Wells' dad, say, "When I saw the building came down and I know he's in there, I fell to my knees and I said, 'Lord, please take me in his stead.'" You're with cracking voice. You can't help but get emotional, and your heart can't help but hurt for his father. Mm-hmm. And you may shed a tear. And there are a bunch of scenes like that that are very tough to watch because this is a family talking about losing their son, this great kid. Mm-hmm. And so we bring you down because you have to hear about that he died, but then you find out how his heroics became revealed through a piece of fabric, a red bandana. You learn how that piece of fabric changes the family's perspective on their loss. They still cry for their son. Their still heart breaks for their son, but their perspective shifts. And then you learn what he did that day, the heroics that he displayed. And then you learn how he's remembered. And he's honored, as I mentioned earlier, through song and poem and artwork and babies named after him. And then finally, and I won't spoil it, but at the end, after you hear this legacy piece and how he's remembered, we share this incredible secret about Wells that literally people viscerally say out loud, "Wow." And they don't even realize they're talking because it's the most incredible and poetically beautiful ending, which is secret about Wells that you find out, that which is hard to believe, but it was 100% true. So we bring that audience back up and lift them up and inspire them. So yes, people cried during the film, but anyone who cries also feels inspired and leaves inspired. So what I think is unique about the movie is even though it is really sad at points, you leave feeling uplifted. And so I believe this film takes the audience on an incredible journey and leaves them inspired and uplifted, which is hard to do when in certain sections of the film it is very sad.
Here now, an excerpt from the trailer for Matthew Weiss's documentary, Man in Red Bandana.
Let's go.
As soon as my wife read this, she said, "This is Wells. They're talking about Wells." I said, I was in the other room. I said, "How do you know?"
They didn't know his name. They didn't know where he came from. But they knew their lives had been saved by the man in the red bandana.
So you get through this process, and it's not a one-off. You know yourself to be a storyteller. You didn't think of yourself as a filmmaker first, but now Matthew Weiss, filmmaker. Take us through the journey to your next effort called Vault. What's that about?
The interesting side note about that, Dan, is that I never thought I'd make another movie. It was a sole focus and responsibility, a weighty responsibility, to get it right for Wells. And to do the research, to get the interviews, speak to the right people, and tell that story in the best way possible, and then get it released as widely as I could. Mm-hmm. We were released in 27 states theatrically, which mm-hmm. for documentary is unusual. Most documentaries don't even get any theatrical release. So once I got past that, you know, that was it. That was how I was envisioning it. But along the way, I met some people, including my current partner, Chad Verde, who saw my documentary and helped me with his team to get it polished and finished and distributed. And we worked together, him and the team, for about 6 months. And in working together, he liked me, and he thought I was smart and, you know, aggressive and organized and authentic. And he asked me if I want to be involved with his next project. He's made 18 films.
Wow.
And so I was honored, and I said, send me the script. And I read it, and it was a story called Vault, about a heist that happened in 1975. But unlike my documentary, this was a feature film with actors and actresses, wardrobes, makeup, props, old cars. It was a 1970s story, and a whole new experience for me. And because I gave without any ulterior motive, just to give back and to preserve a story, I got this opportunity to be a producer at a very high level of this multi-million-dollar feature film. And so Vault was filmed and released last June, mm-hmm. and it's now video on demand. Anyone can watch it on the Amazon or iTunes or any of the other VOD platforms. Mm-hmm. And it's about a story that happened in 1975. $30 million was stolen out of a vault in Providence, Rhode Island. And the twist that you find out very early on in the story is that the vault was not in the a bank where you expect a vault to be, mm-hmm. but rather in the basement of a fur showroom. And the fur business was essentially a front for the New England mob, because this is where the New England mob kept their stolen goods, their cash, their weapons. And pretty much anyone involved in the criminal world in that area knew that that was the mob's, and not to mess with it. You're not going to mess with the mob. Well, these 6 2-bit crooks saw an easy mark with minimal security, and they got roughly $30 million they stole out of that vault.
Wow.
And I'll leave the rest for you to watch, but all I'll tell you and your listeners is that it can't end up well when you rob from the mob.
So, you know, I think our listeners, some of them might know what a film producer does, but they're probably not entirely right. What was your job? What was your job as a film producer? What did you do? What's your value?
That's a great question, because I was under the impression that the executive producer calls the shots, and he or she is the head, because he has that executive title. But it turns out that the producer is actually the one, boots on the ground, kind of like the CEO of the movie. So they're the ones that can hire and fire. They're the ones that can go and say, we're going to go over budget, and we're going to extend filming this tonight. Even though we're at 8 hours, we're going to go to 12 hours. They call the shots. They could say, we're going to, you know, have how many days of shooting. They could get rid of anyone. And so even I had a producer role, but my partner was the lead producer, and I learned and was more of his apprentice and would carry out his instructions. So arguably I could have been, you know, titled associate producer, but he was nice enough to give me the real title. And now him and I are working on a new film called Jungle Room, which is a science fiction movie, and we plan to shoot that one next year. And very different with you know, a futuristic film. You have a more of a clean slate to write with and to tell a story with. And I'm co-writing that with two incredible authors, Tommy DiNucci and B. Dolan. And that script is almost done, and we're going to start filming next year. Very exciting stuff.
So before we pivot off of Vault, there are two fairly well-known actors who had leading performances, Chaz Palminteri and Don Johnson.
Yes.
What was that like working with people from Hollywood again?
That was cool. It was so much fun. You know, I'm like a kid in the candy store. Even though I had some street credibility in the crew because I had made a movie,
right,
you know, for me it was like new stuff, like cool stuff, you know. And we had, the cast was incredible. Not only did we have those two, but we had cameos from Burt Young from Rocky and Big Pussy, Vincent Pastore from The Sopranos. Theo Rossi was one of the leads from Sons of Anarchy. Samira Wiley from Orange is the Next Black. Clive Standen from the TV version show of Taken. And so we had an incredible cast of people and actors, and it was just so much fun. We had a fight scene in a prison, which I got to attend, and, you know, I was an extra for a scene with Chaz in the background. I mean, it was just so cool and so much fun, and I'd like to say, you know, when you give, you get back, and in my case, I made this documentary hoping to break even, you know, but not expecting it, not doing it as an investment, you know, and understanding that I could lose everything. But it really wasn't done to make money. It was done to tell a story, preserve a story, and inspire others. And in doing so, adding to my legacy. So even though I was giving, I was getting back. I got to meet and direct Gwyneth Paltrow. Well, let me say it again. Matt Weiss, a traffic lawyer from New York with no experience whatsoever, got to direct an Oscar-winning actress. I mean, how cool is that experience?
Very cool.
That's just one of many things that came to me because I gave without any benefit, seeking any benefit. And certainly being involved with Vault was just yet another one. And that whole experience of being on set and watching it from the inside was just incredible.
You know, Matt, this is a tough business that you're in. So a couple of my buddies from college went the Hollywood track. One of them produced 300, big budget film. This is tough work. And even if you're financially successful, you're still at the business end of film critics. So you gotta have like asbestos underwear on to keep from getting burned, I guess.
I made my bones fighting traffic tickets and losing plenty of cases. So I had thick skin, my friend.
The movie business has changed quite a bit. You know, theaters today don't show the kinds of films that they showed 20 years ago. I mean, it's big blockbusters. Marsh and I went to a film, not a big blockbuster, in a theater last week, you know, where the new thing now is you have to get reserved seating because I guess in a lot of the theaters, they sell out with the Marvel fair. So here we are, one of six people in a theater with reserved seats. It's just crazy. It's a tough business. A lot of content gets pushed to video on demand, as you just mentioned. How does somebody like you succeed in this new vision of Hollywood?
You know, it's very tough. It is a tough business, and it changes every few years, if not every few months. And it's fragmented and it's competitive. You know, anyone with $3,500 can buy a camera and start filming. So it is a lot more content out there than ever, a lot more smaller outlets to show your content. You know, there's hundreds of film festivals, so there's a lot of competition out there, and it is a tough business. And so you want to be involved with projects that are top quality. For instance, in Jungle Room, what we do is we finished our script, and then we're sending it to William Morris to grade the script. It's called getting coverage. And so they have writers there that read our script, they give back notes, and they give you a grade. And unless our grade is high enough, we don't green light the movie, and we go back to the writing drawing board, and we fix it and send it back until we get a high enough grade where we feel comfortable that this is a solid top script. You know, you can have great actors, but if the script sucks, you know, the great actors will never be able to do anything with it. Now, you could have a great script, and actors could ruin it, but you need to start with that script. It's almost like the foundation for your house. You need a strong foundation, and then you could build upon it and make a beautiful home. It may not come out beautiful, but you need that strong foundation to start.
This is intriguing what you're talking about with William Morris. I didn't go the film school track, and I will admit I don't know a lot about the film business, so that's news to me. But from a business standpoint, how much of the business do you think is just going to be pushed out the video on demand, that's going to be a given for a certain type of film? Even the kinds of films that you're doing?
Yeah, no. Vault released theatrically to 13 theaters, but it was a short few weeks. And then we're relying on video on demand to give us the lion's share of our money back. You know, there are other outlets like international and cable, but we're hoping that our video demand sales were huge. And we're waiting for that. We should know in a few weeks. But that's a clear market strategy that a lot of filmmakers are employing, is the video demand. Most people don't go to movie theaters anymore. They like to watch at home. We have these beautiful TVs with 4K and 75-inch screens in most homes. So why not? Why would you bother going out to a movie theater? You can watch and have a similar experience without leaving the privacy of your home.
Well, and I think of the case in point of Scorsese, The Irishman. It had the cinematic release. It's gone wide, maybe 25 days, and then it's going to Netflix?
Netflix purchased that movie for $140 million. It turns out my partner, Chad, is an executive producer of that film.
Wow.
And so I kind of know a lot about that one that you mentioned. And Netflix paid a lot of money for that. But I think they're doing that because they're competing with Hulu and Amazon and some other streaming services. And they almost is a lost leader to get people to sign up, because if you want to see Irishman, the only place after this theatrical run is going to be on Netflix. And then, of course, I think they're hoping for people to stay on. And you know, you sign up to see Irishman and maybe stay on 6 months or a year or longer. So I think that's their business model as to why they spend so much for it. By the way, highly recommend you get to see that when it gets released later this month. It's the last time you'll have Scorsese, De Niro, and Joe Pesci working together. And obviously, they made three incredible films together, with Raging Bull, Casino, and Goodfellas. And this is the last time those three will ever work together.
So on this podcast, we help people to do meaningful work. And you've had two major chapters in your life that have been truly meaningful. One has been as an attorney. You help people. And now your new one is a filmmaker, where you not only entertain, but hopefully move them emotionally, get them to tap into something that they maybe haven't experienced before in their lives through your storytelling. So somebody listening to this podcast might find themselves stuck in a work role that has turned sour, you know, perhaps even meaningless. And like you demonstrate, we are all capable of finding and doing work that brings us positive meaning, even when it is so radically different from the work we've ever done before. So I ask you, Matthew Weiss, looking back on your career arc, how would you encourage our listeners to seek and do the work of their dreams?
Well, in my case, I had my ears open, right? I was listening, and I heard the story, and I pounced. So, you know, listen for opportunities and be in a position where you can take advantage of them. I had fortunately built a business up to a point where it didn't need me in the day-to-day. I was more working on the business, not in the business. So when I was able to hear Wells' story and have that passion to share it, I was also in the position to avail myself of that opportunity. And so if you don't like what you do, figure out a way to stop doing it. You know, figure out a way to do something that you love. In my case, I loved working on my business and growing the business a lot more than fighting a traffic ticket. You know, it was for me, not standing on my feet and being mistreated by civil servants wasn't really, you know, an exciting thing for me. So, you know, while I did it to start the business and learn the business, ultimately I got myself out of doing that role because I didn't enjoy it, and working myself into something I did enjoy, which is creating systems and processes that allow the workflow to be more efficient, to have better revenue, to save on expenses, and ultimately, you know, get myself in a position where I could pursue other things like do not-for-profit work. I was fortunate at the time I heard Wells' story, I had the free time to take advantage of it and jump in and tell it and become a filmmaker through it.
Well, Matthew Weiss, thank you for walking the tightrope with us. Before we depart, I'm hoping you can point our listeners to where they could find your movies online.
Oh, absolutely. So Man in Red Bandana is available on iTunes, and you can watch The Vault on Amazon or iTunes as well. And Jungle Room will be out probably in 2021, so that one you'll have to wait for. But those are the iTunes for both, and Amazon for Vault would be the best places to see it. And you go to my website, manandredbandana.com. You can learn more about Wells and the story. That we sell bandanas and helmet stickers for kids to give out and tell Wells' story. And you can learn more about me at matthewweiss.com. I do speaking all over the country, and so there's videos and stuff on that website, matthewweiss.com.
Well, thank you again for walking the tightrope.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Our thanks go out to Matthew Weiss for walking the tightrope with us. Links to his films and social media are provided in the show notes for this episode. Our success is your success, but we cannot build our community without your help and support. So if you haven't done so already, please join the Dan Smolin Experience to get our newsletter offering information, tips, and hacks to help you succeed in doing meaningful work. To sign up, simply click the Subscribe to the Dan Smolin Experience newsletter button on our homepage at dansmolin.com. Fill out the short form, then click the Subscribe button at the bottom of the page, and you'll be on your way. Also, become a regular listener of the Tightrope with Dan Smolin podcast. You can easily find current and past episodes by keywording The Tightrope with Dan Smolin at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, on our website at dansmolin.com, or wherever you choose to listen. And don't forget to show your support on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter. You can locate our social media buttons at the upper right corner of our webpages at dansmolin.com. From Washington, D.C., this is The Tightrope. I'm your host, Dan Smolin. And do remember this, our best days lie ahead. Have a great and successful week, everyone.